Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 251, recorded for the week of March 12th, 2024. AI is the final nail in the coffin for low code, and good riddance. Good evening, Matt and Jonathan. How's it going?
It's good, Justin. How's it going?
It's good.
You're good. We're finally recording on schedule. So, you know, only one of us missed the date, which is fine. But three out of four ain't bad. That's how I like to think about it.
Berg's out recording and coordinating for people's personal lives, work, travel, and, you know, everything else is very difficult.
We have built-in redundancy.
Yes. When Ryan was last here a couple weeks ago, we talked about an interesting article that I said I promised listeners that I would bring back when you two were here. Since Ryan's not here, I will have to fill in the gaps here. But basically, we talked about an article in the after show. And for those of you who don't know what the after show is, it's because you don't listen to the end of the episode after the bumper. But we talked about basically, you know, if you go back to rewind to 2020, people all over the place were assuming that, you know, Kubernetes was going to basically disappear. You know, it would disappear. The complexity would get moved away. And then we'd just be worrying about containers and running our containers. And the fidgety bits of Kubernetes would just kind of go away. And we thought Tanzu could be potentially an interesting way to have that happen. You have the cloud providers. But basically, you know, 4 years later now, Kubernetes is still front of mind. It's still super complex. It's still not easy. And, you know, one of the things the article talked about was that, you know, it's hard to put it with guardrails inside of, you know, at a global level, like, you know, how do you use it globally? Like VMware, they're able to kind of standardize how you use it. You can do it inside of an organization, which is how you end up with platform engineering teams, and they create that single opinionated path of Kubernetes. But ultimately, that was kind of the challenge. And so, you know, the three things that Ryan and I kind of came down to was, you know, maybe the pandemic impacted it, you know, the unforeseen complexity of how these things work, and, you know, it hasn't gotten less complex. You know, scalability is a big part of it. And then, of course, the absence of really a clear alternative. Tanzu hasn't really delivered. OpenShift hasn't really delivered. But really, the question to you two is, you know, why do you think Kubernetes hasn't faded to the background?
You want to go first, Matt? Or shall I?
No, you go.
Okay.
I'll let the smarter person with the smarter voice go first.
He's not here. I actually think the pandemic had a lot to do with it. And I don't know what it was about the pandemic that you talked about exactly, but I think we kind of went into this mode where the businesses that were scaling up as a response to the pandemic were like balls to the wall to increase capacity, add new services, do new things. And I think they probably lacked the time to actually go back and redesign or re-implement new patterns. And so I think it probably saw more adoption and more expansion during COVID than ever before, simply because people were focused on delivering that kind of output and not redesigning things. I think the other thing is probably that there's a huge community around Kubernetes. Everywhere you go, there's user groups, there's subreddits, there's on Twitter, there's loads of groups of people. People are very opinionated. People either love it or they hate it, but there's a lot of groups of people who get together and are very passionate about it. They may be wrong, but they're passionate about it. And I think if anything, during the pandemic and social isolation, people probably tended to get together in those same groups and socialize with those same circles. And I think it kind of reinforced their beliefs about the product in general. So those are kind of my two thoughts about why. I mean, it's not a terrible tool. I don't like it. I don't think I'd ever choose to deploy it. And it does fit a need. So I guess part of it is that there really isn't something that's better and as flexible as Kubernetes yet to kind of step in and replace it.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree with the community aspect of it, where I think the community around it is very strong. You know, AWS has the same thing where, you know, there was a lot of sharp edges on AWS back in the day, but they were kind of the first real solution to market at that level of scale around containers. Yeah, there were other companies, Docker Swarm, you know, Rancher, you know, and other ones, you know, that kind of had other solutions. But Kubernetes built the community, I think, around it. And maybe it had to do with the pandemic, like, you know, Jonathan just said. But, you know, people that are all in on Kubernetes, you know, really love Kubernetes and think it's the best thing ever. And, you know, I had a former employee that I'm still good friends with, and he is all in on Kubernetes since like 1.09, and that it's the way of the future and it's going to replace the cloud. And I respect him to hell and back, you know, but I respectfully disagree in a lot of ways with him. But they built this community where people really just went all in. And there's, you know, like you said, and even, you know, Justin and Ryan said, was there's no other real good solution out there for container management. There's Tanzu, but then you got to get into that ecosystem and OpenShift if you really want to stab yourself in the foot. You know, there's just nothing else really there out there. Like, I still kind of like, you know, just using ECS because it's simple. And to me, that was the point of containers, but, you know, it didn't grow. And, you know, I almost feel like Amazon could have maybe grown that ecosystem out if they would have taken it to the next level and maybe open sourced it. But that's obviously a big step. The only other thing I can think of was at the same time as Kubernetes was growing, or shortly after, all the cloud providers were growing too. So the complexity of all the cloud providers, Kubernetes tried to, you know, simplify. Hey, you need a load balancer? Just call this load balancer service. You know, hey, you need this other thing? Just call this other service. And kind of simplified the cloud aspect of it a little bit too.
Got it.
But it's reasonable assumption. I mean, again, a lot of what ifs. You know, what if Amazon had open source ECS? Would that have changed the game in some way? Or, you know, and they kind of did in some cases with Bottle Rocket, you know, at least the core underpinnings of it. All the different provisioners and the different handlers that now are supposed to abstract away the cloud. It really comes down to like, how many abstractions do you really need from compute and silicon? And too many abstractions makes it more difficult. So yeah, well, good additions to the list of what we came up with, and we appreciate you guys doing that.
I think it's probably easy to think about the other way around and say, well, they didn't lose because they weren't complex, because they are, and they didn't lose because, you know, there's lots of reasons they could have died off and haven't. So I don't know. I guess it's just a sign that perhaps it's just the least worst solution right now, and I think it's going to take a few years for the generation of people who've been kind of indoctrinated into Kubernetes, because that's kind of the level of community around it, I think, to sort of move on in their careers and new people to come along and say, hey, maybe this isn't the best way to do things.
I mean, they're pretty, Kubernetes men are a pretty vocal bunch. I don't know that they would accept any answer other than Kubernetes. but it might just take the next generation of infrastructure and software engineers to go like, this just seems super complicated and doesn't make sense, but we'll see. Well, these are the kind of things that we ramble on about in the after show. And if you stick around to the end of this episode, we're going to talk about the Apple car. And we typically talk about things that are cloud adjacent, not really cloud related, that sort of interest the hosts. And so, you know, definitely check out our after show for fun topics that are not always cloud. So, all right, let's move on to general news. Matt, it is week 2 for you to tell us where you're going to be talking from 11:30 to 12:30 in Chicago.
No, actually, I think you said that. I think it's only 11 to 12. So you only have to listen to me for a half an hour, not an hour, because you listen to me enough every week at the podcast when we can get enough of us together. But I'm talking at the Camp IT conference in Chicago. I think it's literally next to the airport, which is nice and convenient for me. So I can fly in and fly out. But I'm doing a talk on using data and AI to shine light on your IT. So kind of talking a little bit about how, you know, my corporate, you know, my day job leverages the cloud and how we're leveraging AI and ML and other, you know, upcoming technologies, as we talk about here weekly, in different ways to help benefit. And so it's kind of a general conference about, you know, just IT trends and cloud overall.
Sounds like a fun time.
If you're in the Chicago area, Justin has promised and sent me a tracking number. So we're hoping that they actually arrive, some stickers that I will have for whoever wants them, and feel free to come up and ask for some.
Yep. I mean, I think you really have to say the ending of this title is the dark IT estate. It's got to be more dramatic because that's a sort of. Now, the website says 11:30, 12:30. So, well, you might need to beef up your presentation.
I was working on it today. So, it is 11:30, 12:30. So, that's good to know.
You're welcome.
So I'll have to add some slides to my presentation that I was working out with my marketing department today. Good to know.
Yeah, I was like, wait, no, I pulled that time off of the website. I'm not that incapable of show notes. All right. Well, we can't wait to hear how your event goes and who we get to meet there at the event. And probably we'll get some new listeners out of it as well. So always fun to do these events. And they're coming back. Doing events in person is starting to become fun again. And yes, you'll get stickers tomorrow. They're supposed to be delivered to your house. So.
Perfect.
All right. Well, let's talk about Cloudflare. There's a couple announcements from them this week because they had one of their user conferences. First up is they are here to protect your LLM with their new development of the firewall for AI to provide companies a layer of protection for artificial intelligence, large language models with an aim to identify potential attacks before they can tamper with critical functionality or access sensitive data. In addition, Cloudflare is launching a new suite of defensive cybersecurity tools that use AI to fight emerging AI threats. And those include detecting anomalies in user behavior, scanning email to flag suspicious messages, and mitigating threats to your organization. The firewall AI will provide security teams the capability to rapidly detect new threats, and it has the ability to be deployed in front of any LLM running on Cloudflare's existing Worker AI offering. Worker AIs allow developers to deploy AI models at the edge at scale on Cloudflare's global network. By putting the firewall in front of the AI, they can scan prompts submitted by the users to identify attempts to exploit the model and extract data you don't want them to have.
It's a good product. I don't think it's going to have much of a life, unfortunately, because I think this functionality will be easily built into commercial offerings. I think we even talked about this a couple of months ago about having kind of a second layer that checks the answers to make sure that it's within the constraints of the intent of the person using the model in the first place. So it's nice that they've got this because nobody else has it yet. I was disappointed there weren't any like good examples of what it could do in there. It's very, very sort of press release, maybe vaporware yet. I'm not sure if it's actually available yet, but an example would have been nice.
Well, I mean, I feel like it's a little bit limited in the fact that it's really just blocking your worker AI stuff, which is, you know, AI at the edge is a whole other level of cutting edge that most people aren't even ready for with their AI workloads. But I think it's a nice idea. I think it has potential. And for a lot of security teams, it's a checkbox. So, you know, it'll probably have something, you know, some value to the business. But yeah, I think it'll probably get suppressed by other things. But yeah, we'll find out over time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's value in having a third party be the firewall and not necessarily trust OpenAI or Anthropic or whoever else to be the gatekeeper as well as the service provider.
Yeah, I feel like this is like, you know, a little bit of a checkbox to me for a lot of companies of, hey, do you have a firewall here? Now we do. Congratulations.
The other announcement from Cloudflare is they purchased a company called Nefeli Networks. And they're rebranding that to become a new product called Magic Cloud Networking that organizations can use to link together workloads running on different cloud platforms. The offering is based on technology the company obtained through that Nefeli Networks, which had raised $9 million in funding from new enterprise associates. Enterprises often require the ability to establish network connections between different public clouds. A revenue forecasting application, perhaps running on Azure, may need to access a Google Cloud database that contains last quarter's earning data. And connecting the two clouds could be difficult as the providers use different networking technologies that don't always interoperate out of the box. Cloudflare says Magic Cloud Networking addresses this challenge. According to the company, the service provides a single pane of glass for managing networks that span multiple public clouds. Using a centralized interface is simpler than the traditional approach of managing each cloud with separate tools. Magic Cloud Networking will take care of configuring your constructs such as VPN gateways, routes, and security groups to securely connect your cloud VPC network to Cloudflare One. And once you're in Cloudflare One, Cloudflare will take care of routing, management, injecting, and withdrawing routes globally across Cloudflare and all connected cloud providers. There's a quote here from theCUBE research principal analyst Bob Liberte. The majority of organizations are now using multiple public clouds in a meaningful way, which is driving the need for solutions that drive greater operational efficiencies and agility. Cloudflare recognized this need, and with the acquisition, it can leverage Nefeli to provide multi-cloud networking capabilities. This is clearly a win for Nefeli and Cloudflare customers and could mark the start of consolidation in the multi-cloud networking space as established vendors look to add this capability to their portfolio. And then the article goes on to say the other big competitors in the space, Aviatrix Systems, Procemo, and Alkira.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a couple of companies a few years ago that I worked with that kind of did the same thing. They acted as a like an MPLS network for you and then routed between all the networks and got rid of either you managing all of it back to your data center or and or kind of gave you the ability to say, hey, I only need, you know, 5 megs or 50 megs out of each solution. So it looks like just another company is kind of now going into that space.
It's an interesting direction to go for Cloudflare. I mean, I've always associated them with, you know, CDNs and edge offerings, and they do have edge compute, but I've always kind of associated them kind of at that place in the network and not necessarily between clouds. So it's I think it's quite a new strategy for them. I wonder if this is actually solving, you know, connectivity between Cloudflare and other clouds, not just necessarily between Azure and AWS or GCP. Maybe it's a sign that they're going to grow.
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea, is like it's connecting the clouds. And I mean, the thing about Aviatrix, for example, and I'm a big fan of Aviatrix as well, you know, their big play is that they're helping you manage your internal cloud network as well as connect clouds together and your private on-premise environment and really make a global network that's all, mm-hmm. you know, very similar to what your networking teams are used to doing. If Cloudflare is going to be like highly focused on just the interconnectivity between the clouds and then routing through the Cloudflare One network, I don't think it has quite the same use cases as something like Aviatrix does, but maybe that's where it'll go over time as they build out the product. But the way this press release works and the limited amount of content on the website so far, I'm not fully sure exactly where it considers its boundaries to be. But I'm definitely, you know, I'm happy to see another competitor in the space. I didn't even know about Procemo and Alkira. So I'm now going to check them out as well, because I know Aviatrix pretty well, but this is an area that, you know, legacy network teams in particular struggle with.
Oh yeah, for sure.
The other big one I knew of was Megaport that I worked with a few times.
But Megaport is really, I mean, yes, they have a bunch of routing capability as well. So their Megaport's actually probably closer to what Cloudflare is doing, except for the fact that Megaport can sell you the pipe.
Okay. I see the difference. So. I wonder if they're trying to get maybe faster connection to the clouds, but, you know, to reduce latency. But I feel like they probably have to have pretty high, you know, pretty low latency to everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I assume that Cloudflare runs on these cloud providers as well as has, you know, pretty fat pipes into them, as well as peering relationships with a lot of these people. That's how they are able to do what they do. But yeah, it's interesting because, yeah, low latency is going to be really the key successful step to this. All right. Well, VMware is back once again, and this time they're selling off their business unit to KKR for $3.8 billion. So for those of you who are using the VMware end user compute products, which is mostly the VMware One suite or the VMware Horizons product, they've now sold that off to KKR, which might be the best news you've heard all week, because, you know, that means that they may not screw you over when it's time to renew your license. KKR happens to own Aludo, which sells Parallels. So this does seem to plug in nicely with the different products they already own. There's also a rumor that they're going to sell the Carbon Black business, which if you're in the next gen fire or antivirus product market, they're a pretty big player in that space as well. And, you know, just part more of the mighty VMware being sold for parts on the highest bidder. So sad to see such a beacon of the tech world for the, you know, 2020s, 2000s dying like this.
Yeah, I feel like we should go through the like transcripts of the podcast and think and kind of pull out everything we've ever said about VMware, because I'm pretty sure we, a couple of years ago, we thought they were dying off, and then they started partnering with everybody, and we thought, oh well, they seem to be making a comeback. Mm-hmm. And now this is just it's kind of sad to see. Really, they've been pretty successful. They've had some good products, and to see them chopped up like this is kind of disappointing in a way. It must be fairly unpleasant for all the employees, but.
Yeah, who are, you know, being told they're not going to sponsor H-1B visas anymore. Right. And, you know, there's lots of dirty stories coming out of VMware right now in the Bay Area, if you're you know anybody who works there.
Yeah, $3.8 billion is 5% of the purchase price of VMware. So yeah. It's kind of wonder if they regret the purchase in the first place at this point.
I mean, I imagine, you know, again, it's not a huge business line. I mean, Horizons was from the acquisition of AirWatch. So, you know, a lot of people are familiar with AirWatch from mobile device days, you know, very early on. You know, it kind of lost its way a little bit and got redesigned as Horizons. And Horizons was a pretty good MDM solution as well. So it's not, you know, these two products actually have potential market still and can, you know, do a lot of things if you're trying to build that market out. But you know, how KKR is going to use it, we'll see. Time will tell.
Yeah, I mean, I think VMware went in some strange directions and their product portfolio was all over the place, and Broadcom very specifically narrowing it down to what they care about for data center workloads. And so, I mean, maybe these products will actually get a better life elsewhere.
Yeah, I think this one might. So we'll see.
Yeah.
All right, on to AI is going great, or AI is how ML makes money. And the OpenAI board reappoints Sam Altman and adds three other directors to the board. So for those of you who remember the OpenAI scandal, where the board fired Sam and then rehired him the following week after all the employees threatened to quit. As part of that coming back, he was not allowed to be back on the board until the investigation was done into did he do improper things which caused his firing. Apparently, Wilmer Hale was a law firm hired to do that investigation and found that Sam's conduct did not mandate removal. Instead, it found that his firing resulted from a breakdown in the relationship and loss of trust between the prior board and Mr. Altman. It also found that the old board acted too quickly without advance notice to key stakeholders and without a full inquiry or an opportunity for Mr. Altman to address its concerns. Most of the board members, of course, were left the board shortly after he was reinstated as CEO. And they have added three new board directors, including Sue Desmond-Hellmond, the former CEO of Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Nicole Seligman, former president of Sony Entertainment, and Fiji Simo, CEO of Instacart, which also increases the number of board directors to 7 now. And I do think it was interesting that they picked up Sue Desmond-Hellmond, considering last week we talked about, while you guys weren't here, we talked about Elon and his big lawsuit against OpenAI and what they were doing. So, yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, here we picked up, you know, a really well-known philanthropic board member to help make sure we keep that going. So well done.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about this whole thing. It seems there's obviously some internal conflict over the difference between being the openness and the necessity to make money to drive the research. But I think there will be old news. I think that the pace of technology is going so quickly now that OpenAI may not be who we think of when we think of LLMs in a year's time. Even I'm sure they'll be an important part of history, but if you look at things like Claude 3, which I've looked at this week, it's absolutely amazing. And I think people are right to say that it blows GPT-4 out of the water. So it's they're going to have to make some money to innovate for sure, but I think they'll become one of many over the next few months.
I agree. I think they're going to definitely become one of many, and they are going to be that first name company that really started the LLM, you know, Gen AI craze that we're currently in.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, I would now like to have you all pat yourselves on the back, as you know, we are a trendsetter, and we said that low code and no code were in trouble with AI, or that AI would basically heavily augment them. And InfoWorld had an article this week where they basically said the exact same thing: generative AI will change low code development. And basically, they were saying, you know, if you take the same amount of effort to do low code as it does talk to a chatbot, it seems like the chatbot's going to win when it writes real code, not just pseudocode. There's a quote here from Anand Kulkarni in an article that I found was interesting. Low code is dying in the enterprise and AI will kill it. The big question is, why would you want to use low code when you can use AI to create full code with the same effort? So nice job, guys. I'm glad we were ahead of this one by about 8 months.
Yeah, we should have a whole section on we were right.
Our egos are already big enough. You know that we need more of we're right.
I feel like that we need a section of we were wrong, which is probably exponentially bigger.
I mean, there's definitely some of those too. There's less of them, but you know, there's a few. Mostly around our predictions, or mostly wrong there.
Yeah.
I was about to say, did anybody predict that Gen AI was going to be the death of low code? That would have been a good prediction.
That would be a good prediction. Yeah.
That's fine.
I have to go back and look. All right. Well, let's move on to AWS. AWS is announcing the availability of provisioned IOPS, IO2 block express storage volumes for all database engines and RDS. IO2 block express volumes are designed for critical database workloads that require high performance and high throughput at a low latency. With IO2 block express volumes, your database will benefit from consistent sub-millisecond latency, enhanced durability to 99.999% over IO1 volumes, and drives 20x more IOPS and gigabits per second, provision storage up to 1,000 IOPS per gigabit at the same price as IO1. You can upgrade from IO1 to IO2 block express volumes without any downtime, significantly improving the performance and reliability of your applications without increasing your storage price. Database engines can support up to 256,000 IOPS and 4,000 megabits per second of throughput, and available for all RDS databases using the AWS Nitro system. And then we have a quote from Samir Goel, director of engineering at Figma. "We migrated all of our primary Amazon RDS instances to IO2 Block Express within 2 weeks. IO2 Block Express has had a profound impact on the availability of database layer at Figma, and we have deeply appreciated the consistency performance with IO2 Block Express. In our observations, the latency variability has been under 0.1 millisecond."
Wow.
I mean, it does cost you an arm and a leg. So I would hope that it does provide the superior performance you're expecting.
But it also is the same price as IO1, which is already costing you said arm and leg. So it's nice that, you know, you can get these, you know, benefits of moving up to the newer tier with the newer technology without a price increase. Though normally Amazon does a price decrease to try to get people to move. So that to me is a little bit of an oddity. With the generalness of IO1 and IO2.
They probably do tell you it's a price increase because, it's you know, price per IOP, you know, has gone down. and so that's how they'll tell you it's still a cost cut, no matter what, even if it's not really.
I always wonder what kind of what the breaking change is, like what they need to do and why they just like shove it into IO1 and behind the scenes migrate people. Like, what about it do they want to force people to take on this? Because I feel like now they have to maintain two production systems or just one.
Well, I assume for net new RDSs, the default is IO2. But maybe for back compatibility, they still support IO1.
I think they want to tell people.
It's just two full systems they have to support now.
They want to turn it into an announcement, though. I mean, a product is a product and it has a fixed set of requirements, and they make an announcement about a new product. It's one extra announcement they can talk about at reInvent. And it's, innovation.
I mean, I meant about like IO1 versus IO2, or like a lot of these, like, you know, under the hood increases. Like, this is already storage. It's already, you know, completely broken out. You still select the quantity of IOPS. It's not like GP2 to GP3, where like, GP2 to GP3, where you have to like, you know, select your IO that you want and your throughput that you want. We're like, okay, now there's a fundamental difference the way it operates. Here, I thought, and maybe I'm wrong because I haven't played with IO because I don't like to open my checkbook for massive sums of money here. You know, it's just you specify the IO. That's it.
I wonder if it's a migration thing too. Like, you know, they want customers to make the choice, and then they'll help, you know, they can put pressure on through the sales team to get people off of IO1. But, you know, some databases may not easily move over, or they, you know, you still have IO1 for the non-Nitro instances, perhaps. Although why you're running a database still on non-Nitro, I don't understand. there's probably some reasons, but I bet they would probably push people to IO2 over time and then quietly start deprecating IO1.
Things like this kind of raise questions in my mind about exactly what the architecture looks like in a data center of how these things are deployed. I always assumed that RDS was just a custom EC2 instance running alongside everybody else's EC2 instances in the big pool of compute, but maybe it's not. But maybe not having availability for IO2 in RDS previously was a sign that there literally wasn't that piece of hardware where RDS was running. And I assume to get this type of latency, it needs to be very close to a rack.
Yeah. I mean, also might be a certification thing too, right? Like if you go change this out underneath an Oracle database and then you corrupt data, that's a pretty bad thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you build IO2 and then you probably go through some pretty rigorous testing to make sure you can provide the five nines of availability and the durability requirements that you're giving. I imagine there's probably a pretty robust testing thing, and they'd rather have you break this on your non-RDS database because that's probably less important. And then once they have confidence in IO2, then they can start making it available.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, I know it says you can migrate without downtime, but there's certainly a performance impact when you're migrating those blocks to the new storage.
Sure.
But that's not downtime. That's performance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Differences.
It's in the words that we choose to use.
Yeah.
Yeah. But who needs bare metal with this kind of performance now? It's quite impressive.
They don't want you to use bare metal as much as possible.
So. Yeah.
The only reason you use bare metal is when you have to deal with Windows licensing on AWS, which then requires a PhD in Windows licensing.
It requires a PhD in licensing in any environment, not just AWS.
True.
Speaking of costs of craziness, let's talk about cost categories. So Amazon a couple weeks ago, maybe last week, Matt and I were on, refresh the console experience for the WAF, which we were very excited about. And this week, they're giving us the new experience for the AWS cost categories to simplify the cost category creation workflow. The new user interface uses a split view panel to improve the process of setting up cost category rules, as well as provide an interactive preview of the allocation of month-to-date estimated charges based on all the rules you've set. So your panel allows you to add or edit cost category rules or visualize their effectiveness on cost allocation without leaving the consolidated view for all of your rules in the rules tab. Or rules table. So yeah, that's nice. I also played with this one right away. This was one I was not as familiar with the old user interface because I had not really used this that much. But the ability to kind of slide things in and out and see how your carve outs will look and what they'll do to the value before you submit them is very handy.
Mm. So how does it work exactly? So when you build a cost category, is it like you is it just a rule that says like this tag becomes a category? Is it just a way of grouping resources?
Yeah, but you also can do rules like this port, you know, I want to split the cost into two different things, and you can do cost allocation into the categories. So a bunch of things you can do.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah. I was trying to play with this before the show, and we are at like an hour and a half to 2 hours probably. And I'm still trying to get this to generate me the first cost category for a very small environment that's like maybe a couple thousand a month.
That's because you're not spending enough.
Yeah, you're not spending enough money, man.
Oh, sorry. I have it backwards. If I spend more money, it runs faster because has to process more data.
Yeah.
Love that AWS bill.
Yeah. That's how, you got to get this flywheel spinning, and $1,000 is going to get that flywheel moving, man.
There you go.
Well, if you are stumped by AI at your company and you're looking for partners to help you out, but you just said, I don't know who's certified or has the right competency. Amazon has you this week with the new AWS Generative AI Competency, which is designed to tell you which partners have shown the technical proficiency and track record of continuing success with customers while implementing generative AI tech powered by AWS. And I'm sure there's a ton of partners right now falling all over themselves to get these competencies. So don't hold it against your vendor if they don't have it right away, because they're in a very large line for the five people who can do competency certifications to get to them to come review what they're doing. So it's not that great of a cert, or any of these competencies really aren't that great. Now that we don't have Peter here, I can disparage the partner program. The competencies are BS.
It's a lot of work because I helped Peter through a lot of those over the years. And I guess he's not here to tell me anyone that I'm lying or not. So we'll just keep with that theory going, because Peter always did the majority of the work. But I saw that long list of stuff that you have to do. And it's not easy as a small business to put together all the documentation and go through the audits and everything else that you have to do. Sure, yeah. If you're a massive, 5-10,000 person company, it's easy to do those. But the small business, it's hard to go through all that documentation and paperwork.
And it's really, that's the problem I have with it. It's really about the paperwork. It's not about your actual ability, capability. It's about, can I produce the documentation and evidence that I know what I'm doing to satisfy this Amazon person who, is job.
Doesn't understand it.
He doesn't understand it fully. And his job is to make sure you don't get the competency, because they're supposed to be hard about it. And so, I'm not a huge fan of the competencies in general, but, yeah, it's nice that if you are looking for this additional certification for your partner, that they have it. Cool. But don't hold a lot of hope on it being me or a good partner or a bad partner.
Yeah, I think we're still a little too early to even say that we know what competency is at this point.
Well, I mean, so that's one of the things too. If you get the competency early, it's really easy. If you want to renew the competency a year from now, it's really hard. Yeah. So you have a lot of partners who
you always want to get into these programs early.
And then they'll have it for a couple of years, and then they won't be able to maintain it because they've upped it to make it so hard that they can't compete on it. Like, even on like the basic DevOps competency where you're going to help companies set up their infrastructure and run their apps there. I mean, like, they got into ridiculousness of that competency where they were like, oh, you need to provide them a separate console experience that gives them the ability to analyze their bill more effectively. I'm like, why would, you know, like, that's not, has nothing to do with what you're asking this competency to do.
So I feel like it's all it does is drive like sales across product lines.
Yeah,
it does. Yeah. I mean, the other piece of a lot of it is, like Justin said, it's hard to get in. Once you're in, they'll help you get leads, but it's still, even once you get the competency, it's who you know, and it really just opens up, you know, other funding mechanisms. And that's really where a lot of the benefit comes from the partner, which is, hey, you have now access to A, B, and C funding that you didn't have prior to this, which helps the end people.
Agreed. All right. CloudFormation has gotten a speed boost. Now, I'm a little unsure about this because the just percentages. And I remember the last time they told me CloudFormation got 50% faster, and then I went and used it. It didn't feel 50% faster. So now they're saying it's 40% faster than the 50% faster it was previously. And they've been able to do that by creating a new stack creation event called Configuration Complete. This event is available at both the stack and the resource levels. And so when customers create your stack, AWS makes your API calls AWS services to create the resources that emits the create in progress. And then signaling the start of the resource provisioning and create complete typically indicates the end of the provisioning. But now before they issue the create complete, they'll issue the configuration complete, which basically says the resource is created and your configuration is applied, but it has not started its eventual consistency check yet or completed the eventual consistency check. And because it has at least completed its configuration, CloudFormation will now leverage this to start parallel creation of dependent resources within the stack, which results in a net faster stack creation experience without any changes. So that means if you only provision one thing with your CloudFormation, it is not 40% faster. It's only if you're doing lots of things with your CloudFormation stack with lots of dependencies, that's where you get that speed boost. So don't get too excited if you have a very simple infrastructure.
And if it's a stack though versus a template, now you're dealing with multiple accounts, which is the other piece of this. So that I'm trying to figure out if they did it just for the stack, aka the, hey, we've deployed this to this whole organization unit, or if it's just within the account. Because there's now other levels of that which also come into effect.
Yeah, I don't really know.
I will say, while I'm not a CloudFormation person, leveraging it for like general base stuff at the high level, like saying like, hey, we want to enable guard duty or whatever in all your accounts, like leveraging that at an organizational level is actually pretty nice. I think I might have just got shot in the face with by Justin and Jonathan on this call with like the stares of like, why the hell would you ever do that? But
I got into CloudFormation before Terraform. And so I do like CloudFormation, but starting off with JSON CloudFormation was a bit of a nightmare, especially once you had to build things modularly. So YAML CloudFormation,
I never got into it.
Saved my soul. It's nice because at least you can copy paste chunks and things in. And then, you know, it's matured a lot over the years, but I still think I have like moved away from it a lot now, partly because I'm not using AWS as much as I used to, but I think still think Terraform is my go-to for things in general. But
it took you a long time to get there.
It did. I mean, I do. There's a lot of nice things about CloudFormation that you can't do with Terraform easily.
Yes.
Like nested stacks were kind of nice.
And change sets were kind of nice too.
Yeah.
That only took them how many years?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it came late, but you know, when it was one of those, like, I had already moved over to Terraform when YAML came, and I was like, might go back to CloudFormation, but like, no, I'll stick with Terraform. But then change us, and I was like, okay, now I'm more interested in potentially going back, but I never did.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not bad, but I still feel like Jonathan said, the nested templates, you do a little bit more on boot up than like requiring your remote executions or anything like that. To me, the base infrastructure at the AWS level, the stuff that just runs is nice. Don't get me wrong. I'll probably look at the Terraform documentation to figure out how to write the CloudFormation because Terraform documentation is better. Yeah. But, you know, I definitely have done things of like, hey, go deploy AWS config in all my accounts inside my organizations. And not having to boot up something after it launches and just know that as soon as that account gets created in the organization, it automatically gets these templates applied to it is a nice feeling.
Mm. I'm slightly concerned about this whole skipping the eventual consistency checks. I mean, like, what was it doing exactly when it's doing that? And why is it safe to continue with building the rest of the stack? I assume, if those checks fail, it can still fail the stack and it'll undo everything. But
I would assume as well. But I mean, I don't know what the eventual consistency state is. And so, yeah, it's a question of, you know, are you just doing a double validation and that validation takes a long, you know, it's like running a regression test. It takes a while. And so, you know, We wait for the regression test to pass, but we know we think it's good, then why can't we proceed with the next step in the process?
Yeah. I mean, I guess overall, I'm happy that it's faster. No complaints.
Yeah. I mean, if I go back to it, I'll be glad it's 40% faster or 50% faster of a number that they never baselined ever. So I appreciate that.
Yep.
All right. Let's move on to GCP. Google is announcing a partnership with Elastic, and this is where Jonathan hangs up, to support Elastic Cloud on Kubernetes or the ECK product on GKE and Autopilot mode for operation. GKE Autopilot is the default and recommended mode of operation to run your applications on GKE, and Autopilot fully manages your cluster for you, but still gives you access to full Kubernetes API and all the control you need to fine-tune your workloads and performance. Elastic Cloud on Kubernetes, or ECK, is their official Elastic operator for Kubernetes. ECK is a great way to run the Elastic stack on your cloud-native Kubernetes environment. And now you get automated Kubernetes with automated ECK, and may God have mercy on you when all this implodes in your face in a horrific way.
Well, good. I mean, honestly, what Elastic really needed was a way to manage a cluster effectively. And if this is that solution, then great.
I mean, it's part of the problem, but their other problem is index management.
I'm trying to see the light. I was just
thinking about all the ways, like, I'm like, how Kubernetes can screw up your Elastic cluster. And I'm thinking about some of the outages that we had on Elastic. I'm like, oh, if that was on top of Kubernetes, oh my God. Like, it's a lot of complexity and a lot of troubleshooting to have to deal with, for sure.
I'd love to know how it works under the covers, because I know the Elastic nodes have some very specific ways of working, unique identifiers per host and things. I'd like to see how I've kind of hacked that to kind of make it work in a containerized way safely.
Way JFrog did. Not well. Sorry, bitter things that popped back into my mind.
Well, this operator is open source. I mean, open source, I'm putting quotation marks for Kubernetes, for Elastic open source. But you can go see how they try to do it, and then you can let us know if you're like, oh yeah, this is going to blow up really bad. I just assume that by default, so they didn't think it all the way through, because that was how their cloud service used to run too.
Yeah, I'll take a look.
All right. Well, you know, security in the cloud can be difficult with lots of tools. Multiply that by multiple cloud providers, and now things get even more tricky. So typically, in a multi-cloud world, you'll resort to move to third-party tools that are cloud agnostic, leaving behind the tools you would have leveraged from the native cloud provider. But Google is here to now help you this week by announcing Security Command Center Enterprise, the industry's first cloud risk management solution that fuses proactive cloud security and enterprise security operations, supercharged by Mandiant expertise. Built on Google's Cloud Security Fabric, Security Command Center Enterprise can help break down the silos of tools, teams, and data that separate cloud security and enterprise security operations. And the solution provides a SIEM-powered visibility and SOAR-driven kind of actionability is now brought into the world of cloud security. There's a bunch of capabilities included, including agentless and agent-based vulnerability management for finding security weaknesses in virtual machines, containers, and more. Security posture management to uncover cloud misconfigurations that could create gaps in defenses. Threat detection using specialized technology built into the cloud infrastructure and threats and rules of indicators of compromise curated by Mandiant. Integrated response workflows to efficiently remediate threats. Attack path visualization to see how the hacker just burned you. Google recommended preventative and technical controls. Posture and governance controls, giving DevOps and DevSecOps teams ability to design and monitor security guardrails. Cloud identity and entitlement management. A data security posture management. And shift left security capabilities for discovering issues before runtime. All included in their assured open source software capabilities. So
there you go.
This is really great. A lot of buzzwords there. but I mean, I appreciate this because Command Center is not a bad product other than it costs a fortune. And now if I can cost that fortune, but also get it on multiple clouds and my legacy environment and move all of my SOC operations together, this gets much more interesting, much quicker.
Yeah, definitely. Anything to replace Qualys would be a win in my book.
Yeah, not a Qualys fan, huh?
Not a Qualys fan.
Not really either, but our security team is, so enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite a portfolio of features they got right there.
It is. I mean, I wonder how it can actually connect some of the things together. It was a little vague on, you know, like, do you give it API keys for the other clouds, you know, agentless and agents? Does that mean you have to support, you know, install a network? It wasn't fully clear some of the details. Yeah. But they do have some sessions happening at Google Cloud Next. So potential opportunities to learn more while I'm there. So I will definitely be checking out one of those sessions.
Yeah, it's always the little things, isn't it? Like if you find out that for every project that you want to monitor, you need to paste in a special, you need to create a role for it to assume, or some other clunky things which become difficult to manage at scale. So the truth will be in the eating, I guess.
The pudding? Proof is in the pudding?
The pudding, that's right.
All right. Well, so Azure likes to do these articles where they dump a ton of things they announced but didn't bother writing a blog post. And so typically I catch these and I don't really talk about them here. But, you know, we haven't covered everything in this one or ignored it for being dumb, which was a common other thing. So there's a few things this one that jumped out to me as something that maybe listeners may be interested in. So first up was the Azure OpenAI Service Assistance API is a new model for fine-tuning text-to-speech and more. Fabric is now HIPAA compliant. I do look forward to Wiz and Orca getting access to my PHI data on Fabric. It'll be really great. Native document support for PII and redaction and summarization. Two new FinOps tools for sustainability, including Azure Carbon Optimization and Microsoft Azure Emissions Insights. SQL Server enabled by Azure Arc now offers Azure SQL Migration Assessment. There's a new migration service for Azure Database for Postgres. And Azure SQL Database Hyperscale outpaces Amazon Aurora PostgreSQL by up to 68% in performance and value, which they did not provide any additional metrics of how that is or how that was done. So you just had to take their word for it.
Performance and value. Lovely, lovely buzzwords. That's cool.
I mean, it's 68% better.
Yeah.
I guess I do appreciate Azure not just putting out an article for every single tiny announcement that they could possibly think of. So it's kind of, they do the opposite of AWS in a little bit of a way.
I mean, Google's actually the best at it. They do a really nice job on their roll-up posts, and they typically add value in their roll-up posts, where this one just was a blah, you know, it's a vomit of text that you have to decipher and decide if it's important to you.
Yeah, I read through it. I was like, cool. You know, the Fabric one, HIPAA, if you're in a healthcare world, sure, it makes sense. But, you know, I didn't feel like there was a lot of value in most of the things that they kind of already talked about in other articles, too.
Yeah.
I like the PII redaction, though, and summarization. Those are really useful features.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at Amazon, like, hey, can you guys get on this, too? Because, I mean, with DLP on Google and now this with Azure, I've got two vendors providing a capability that Amazon doesn't have. All right, well, that's it for this week in the cloud. See you guys next week.
See you later.
Bye, everyone.
And that is The Week in Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet us with the hashtag #PoundTheCloudPod. All right. So some big news happened in the world of self-driving cars. I don't know if you guys knew this or not, but Apple has killed Project Titan. 10 years and $10 billion of investment down the drain as they shutter their self-driving electric car project. It's considered one of their most ambitious projects, with nearly 2,000 employees working on the project. And the project has had its issues with several reorgs and leadership changes that have reset the program. Many employees on the team will be shifted to the artificial intelligence division. Focusing on generative AI projects are increasingly a key priority for Apple. There will be some portion of people laid off, probably people who like cars, and the stock did not care this happened. Overall, I think it's interesting. This is killing, you know, they're killing this. I think I owe a friend of the show a bet that I made him that we'd have full self-driving by like 2025 or 2026, something in there. And he told me I was crazy. And I was much more optimistic in the technology, I think. and our ability to overcome the technical challenges that were going to be a self-driving problem. And so, yeah, I'm going to come up short on that bet, I'm pretty sure. And so I tried to send him money now in advance before the bet ends. But yeah, is this just a sign that, you know, the tech isn't there and everyone's, you know, we'll table this one for 10 or 15 years and then revisit it with a bunch of new startups? Or do you guys think Apple's missing the mark altogether?
You know, I think the fact that the stock was unimpacted is the biggest indicator that nobody thought they were ever going to do it anyway. I know it was a huge expense. It was a nice project. I don't think we really have any idea what work they actually generate, you know, what product they actually generated for their money over the past 10 years. I know some of the, you know, they supposedly built an M3 Ultra chip, which was meant to power the AI in the vehicles. So that's around now. That's something that's useful and tangible that they can reuse somewhere else.
I imagine a lot of the technology that came out in the new Vision Pro comes from this project. You know, because if you have a self-driving car, how do you keep people entertained in a car? Well, you know, augmented reality headset might be a good way to do that if you're by yourself. So I could see the, you know, that probably led to some of the car stuff. I imagine a lot of the AI enhancements that they're going to be able to ship now, you know, based on the M processors and what they're going to now future probably build LLMs into the Apple phones, I think will, you know, comes directly out of this project. So I think there's a lot of benefits that are coming out of the R&D of this. They're just not a car. So I don't think it's a complete waste, but.
Yeah, no, certainly not.
I just think it wasn't their core competency. Like, their core competency is consumer grade, you know, laptops, phones, that type of stuff, not cars, factory robots, things along those lines. So to me, this always felt like a little bit of a stretch for them, you know, versus like a Uber whose business is, well, yes, originally was cars, you know, and delivery and stuff like that, you know, where it's a little bit more fundamentally their business. That being said, I don't really want, you know, Land Rover who can't figure out how to get my Android to connect to the Bluetooth because for some reason it's not compatible, which still don't understand how Bluetooth is not compatible with the phone to the car, creating me an electric car and a self-driving car. That terrifies me a little bit.
Yeah. But I mean, the reality is Land Rover is not making those parts for you anyways, because most of like the technology that's in cars is all made by other manufacturers and just licensed to them to be built into the cars. Like most of the head units, most of the adaptive cruise control modules, like all of that stuff is all typically made by third parties that they then sell to all the car manufacturers. So
yeah, I'd say like Denso or Bosch, basically everything, they make all the parts for everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I still think, I mean, they've killed the car project. I still think in the future there will be things like Apple robots. I mean, there's the Tesla Optimus bot, and then, you know, other people working on humanoid type robots. I think it would be foolish to think that they're not going to build something like that in the future. It won't be a car. It's obvious. I think they've missed the boat on the cars situation, with Tesla about to roll out the, you know, the AI only full self-driving for their fleet.
Are they though? Because they, yeah. I mean, Elon's been promising that now for how many years?
Well, I don't care about Elon anymore. He's dead to me. But, there's a lot of good videos. It's still not quite there, but the things that it has solved are absolutely fantastic to watch. So I think Apple wouldn't stand a chance because they don't have the data. I mean, Tesla have got millions of miles of video recordings to train their models on, and they've already demonstrated that coding your way around navigating roads is not the solution. I mean, you have to do it by modeling human behavior. And so without that data, Apple wouldn't stand a chance at being successful in this.
I'm just saying, I don't really want to model
humanoid robots though.
I mean, we assume that Apple doesn't have that, you know, doesn't have that data, but what about Google, who was pioneering self-driving way before Tesla even existed, you know, with all their bots down in Mountain View. And then you have, you know, companies like Waymo, who, you know, that's all they've been focusing on. So you can kind of argue that Apple's is just a distraction and they were never serious. But, you know, Tesla does have the cars that are on the road, so they're definitely getting a lot of data. But, you know, these other car companies, they have cars on the road too. So, you know, but they're struggling too. Waymo is not doing great. So, you know, is it really?
No.
You know, I guess the question is, would you be willing to put your family into a Tesla with full AI self-driving and send it on its way? And would you feel confident in that? And I, just based on what's happened with, you know, the self-driving capabilities of the Teslas already and how many people it's killed, I'm not sure I'm fully there yet.
No, I think I would, because it's changed a lot since I've had that car had the Model 3 with self-driving for 5 years. So I think self-driving came maybe a year after that. So it's been 3 years of self-driving. It has changed. It is not the same vehicle that it was back then. The leaps have been enormous. So I would put my family in a car and would it get them there? Maybe not. Maybe it'll pull over to the side, but I trust that the things that it does will be safe things.
See, I just worry about all the other drivers on the road.
Oh, yeah.
Forget the actual Tesla driving. Like, it's not me that I'm worried about on the road. It's the 17 terrible other drivers. And that's being a driver that's driven in really fun states like Florida, Massachusetts, California, New Jersey, you know. People suck at driving because it's not a primary activity. It's a secondary activity to most people. So, you know, the car needs to be super defensive and super conservative. And that's hard to emulate of, like, you know, watching other vehicles. And yes, it can see things that I'm sure I can't see on the road, but, you know, I know I'm paying attention and probably have, you know, the ability to kind of know, you know, what humans think a little bit better than cars do, hopefully. I'm going to get a bad car accident next week. So, you know, and knock on wood right now and move on.
So the word you said, attention, is the absolute key to the whole thing, though, because Waymo with their LiDAR and their 12 cameras and whatever else, they have so much data, they just don't know what to do with it. They don't know what they can discard and they don't know what's important. And they find it very hard. So the compute requirements just go through the roof. So a machine that can learn what's important to pay attention to and what's not, just like people do, is probably the solution to this. It's why I think Waymo's not going to be successful in the long run. It's why they have to roll out city by city, because they have to map every centimeter of every city in immense detail before they can actually build a service there.
Hmm. That'd be interesting.
Yeah. Not surprised Apple killed it. Surprised it lasted as long as it did, but I still think we'll see AI driven products from Apple in the next few years.
Yeah, I'm very excited to see what Apple does this year for the iPhone and what they, because I suspect they're going to do some type of major enhancement to Siri, because it just makes sense that they would at this point.
I hope so.
You know, it's so long in the tooth and so inferior compared to Alexa and other things that this is the first chance they really have to take technology and really make it better. So, you know, hopefully they do something, and if they can put that on board to the device, because that's one of Apple's big things is, you know, they don't want to send stuff back to the cloud. They want to maintain privacy as much as they can. So they have in the M chips, they have that capability with the, you know, with all of the graphics processing to do their own AI work. So I'm curious what they're going to come out with. I think it might be cool.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's too early this year, but at least next year.
Yeah. Just saying, I mean, they've got, I would not doubt for a second that Apple and Google and Amazon as well have got transcripts of every single conversation that anybody has ever had with their bots. Mm-hmm. And they can go back and they can train a new version on the outcomes of those conversations. So if Siri says, "Is that what you meant?" and you said no, and the person asks another question, then you can retrain the next bot to understand what the original intent was. So that the data that's available for, I don't know how long Siri's been around for, like 20 years? Long time.
It can't be 20 years, is it? I'm looking right now. Hold on. Real-time follow-up.
Yeah.
2016. Oh, sorry.
18 years.
Supported products, new iPhones, iPod Touch, 2012. Standalone Siri. No, maybe 2012. So, yeah, it's 12 years.
Okay, 12 years. That's still a lot of conversations with that many iPhones out there.
It's a lot of swearing at phones out there. Just saying.
Well, see, it was his own company before. So Siri was released as an app for iOS in February 2010. And then Apple acquired them and integrated into the 4S, which they shipped on 2011. Mm. And then basically they rolled out to all their other products after that. So, yeah, I guess, okay, a little interesting. But yeah, I do remember buying that company.
And Alexa was in 2014. So think about my conversations, you know. Yeah, Amazon has.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, Google always had the lead on this because they had Google Voice first. And the big thing they did with Google Voice was transcription of voicemails. And that mm-hmm. was how they trained most of their AI voice models was through that, because you could submit back to them corrections to the voicemail. So if it transcribed it weird, you could then send them back like, oh, hey, this word was actually this. So it used, that's where most of Google's voice stuff comes from, is from the original Google Voice product back in the late, 2007, 2008 timeframe, which then fed into their Home Assistant too. So they have that data, plus now all the Home Assistant data. The Google stuff is pretty powerful.
Exciting times.
Exciting
times. What a great time to live.
So I guess if Apple's not going to build a car, what's their next big growth product? A robot would be cool, but robot technology is even further behind than where cars are.
I just want a MacBook with a touch screen. Come on.
There's that company that does it for you.
It's $3,400. You can buy it right now.
Yeah. Jonathan, there is a company I remember from years ago that you could buy a Mac that they retrofitted with touch screen.
Oh, wow.
It was like an extra like $2,000. Mm-hmm. So, it wasn't cheap.
Why do you want to touch on your Mac? Exactly.
So he can code on the screen.
I love my iPad, which is touch. But like having used touch Windows laptops, never want that. It's terrible.
I mean, we have like a Lenovo Yoga, which is the two-in-one. It just fold, the screen folds flat backwards and you can use it like a tablet. Mm-hmm. And it's just nice. It's just nice to use. I'd like a convertible, iPad/MacBook.
Well, they say they're working on a foldable iPad, so we'll see.
Ah, all right.
The problem is it would cannibalize one business for the other, so they have to decide if they'll get enough new sales to cannibalize the iPad business, because I would do the same thing. I could just fold my screen back, have a full laptop, and then flip and use it as an iPad or whatever while I'm somewhere, it'd be great.
But yeah, I mean, the problem is that touchscreens just use a ton of battery. People don't realize quite how much battery goes to running a touchscreen. So the 12, 14 hour battery life for the M3 laptops or something would be 7 hours with a touchscreen. So it's probably not in their interest, really.
All right. Well, I guess we'll let you guys go. Have a good one.
It's good to be back, finally, after I have no idea.
Yeah, nice to have you as well. We missed your analysis on a lot of AI stories that we covered while you were gone. We're like, Jonathan was here. He'd tell us why Claude 3 is amazing. But, based on the press release, sounds pretty great.
It is. It really is. I'll probably talk more about that because I'm going to do some sort of comparative test between Claude 3 and ChatGPT, or GPT-4 at least. So, yeah.
Good deal. All right. See you guys next Tuesday.
See ya.